and welcome to another edition of 20 Minutes In, the film podcast in which we look at the opening 20 minutes of films, both great and terrible, and sort of have a look at how that establishes the tone, the characters, etc. for that movie. As always, I am your host, Robert Beams, and I'm joined as ever by Mr. Tom Oliver. Hello, Tom.
Hello there.
Hi, Tom. So what are we, as if I don't know, and as if the dear listener doesn't know from the title of this very podcast, what film are we looking at this month?
Well, today I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about our Lord and Saviour, Mr. Stanley Kubrick, and one of his, I guess, unsung masterpieces. I really feel like in his whole filmography, this film is grossly underrated for several reasons, which I'll get into. This film being, of course, Barry Lyndon, 1975's Barry Lyndon, for which is the film we are talking about today, or at least the first 20 minutes.
It's interesting that you say about it being a bit underrated, because it certainly used to be the case. But I feel Barry Lyndon's one of those films that's had a bit of a reappraisal in recent years, to the point where it's almost now the Jackie Brown of his filmography. I feel like it is the choice if you don't want to say one of the like mainstream
obvious ones.
Yeah, exactly. It has long been my favourite Kubrick movie. I need to predate my fandom there.
I think I place it, I guess, if I was to do a top three, I think 2001 is still the one to beat, the benchmark, regardless of its, you know, massive cultural status. And Barry Lyndon is second. I guess third would be, I feel like I'm forgetting an obvious one here. Clockwork Orange would not be in there. So what else has he got? He's done some others, isn't he? He's done some movies.
I can't remember any of them now.
Maybe Eyes Wide Shut.
Clockwork Orange would probably be third for me. I feel like, as I think a lot of people feel with Clockwork Orange, that the kind of second half of it is less fun than the first. But it's interesting because before we were recording this podcast, we were talking a bit about Joker, which is coming out soon. And I feel like Clockwork Orange is a bit of a proto-Joker, isn't it? You've got, or even like, you know, like people's criticisms of Wolf of Wall Street as well when that came out. This sort of idea that maybe it's a film that, in its kind of satire or its kind of analysis of these people, glamorizes them in some way, because obviously the stuff with the Droogs is all very quotable and entertaining, and there was a lot of panic at the time. I mean, the film was banned in the UK for the idea that it was sort of promoting and celebrating kind of youth culture, gang violence and rape, and all this business. So I think the beginning sort of half an hour, 40 minutes of Clockwork Orange probably puts it into third for me.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what my official maybe it would be Clockwork Orange, but I don't know. I find like Clockwork Orange, I think is really the whole sort of central concept, I think, is played out really, really well. But I find it for his films just very awkwardly paced, like very kind of, I don't want to say baggy because that's kind of just a bit reductive, but like it is, I feel like, knowing his work overall and how he sort of relays information or how he tells stories in general, it feels just very kind of like just a bit too kind of relaxed for me.
I think for me, Clockwork Orange, 2001, Barry Lyndon and The Shining all having common...
The Shining is number three, of course. That's the one I was forgetting, The Shining.
But for me, all three of those have in common something, which we'll talk about now when we kind of go into talk about Barry Lyndon. They all have in common the fact that from the moment I press play and the music comes in, there's something about the way Kubrick does the opening credits and the choices he makes for the opening music and then the opening narration he has, because in a couple of those films there's this kind of a narration as well, and that really just pulls you in and then doesn't let you go. We both talked about how watching Barry Lyndon for this podcast, and it's a 3-hour movie, but we both had to force ourselves to not watch the whole thing, right?
Yeah, because it's just so absorbing.
I put it on this morning before the pod and was sort of 50 minutes in thinking, okay, I need to go back and watch the first 20 a couple more times. But it's so absorbing, and I get that from the first kind of chords of Ludwig van at the beginning of Clockwork Orange and the credits that are those kind of just garishly bright colours that are kind of almost clashing colours between the fonts and the text and the background colour, and in the beginning of 2001 that has just black space for the opening 5 minutes and obviously like classical music, and those films all pull me in. The Shining does something very similar with that. Is it the instrument, the kind of
Dies Irae in The Shining?
Yeah,
Yeah, yeah.
The one at the beginning there. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just you doing that makes me kind of immediately see the images in my head of them driving in the opening of the film. And I think Kubrick, with a lot of them, but to be honest, right now, I can't remember what the opening music or shots are of Full Metal Jacket, for example.
It's the guys getting their heads shaved. I can't remember what music's playing though.
Yeah.
That is a fairly uncharacteristic, unremarkable opening for that film, I think.
I think so. And I think as well for a lot of his earlier films, I wouldn't say any of them have bad openings because I'm a huge fan of Kubrick. But I think those four I mentioned, they all really grab you immediately. I think they really suck you in. And every time I put one of them on for a bit, I think when I bought the Blu-rays originally years ago, I was putting one of them on just to look at the menus and see what was on there. And as soon as you press play on the movie, you end up just sitting and watching the whole thing.
You just have to, yeah. It's really interesting because we don't have to cover the ground of like meticulous Kubrick and well researched, because that's obviously stuff that everybody knows at this point, is that he goes to great pains to make things just work, essentially, in so many ways, or just create a kind of atmosphere or make a movie work in whatever terms. But he doesn't rely, at least for his openings, he doesn't rely on like salacious inciting incidents to kind of like get you like enraptured in the narrative. He just creates a kind of atmosphere. Like, obviously, the most obvious case being, we were talking about 2001, where the opening 20 minutes is complete silence, and it's all to do with the kind of the dawn of man and the sort of primitive apes and their relationship to this monolith, which becomes important later on. And then the 20-minute mark is the point at which that bone goes into the sky and then it turns into the spaceship and it's leaping forward, you know, millions and millions of years. And
another
I feel
strange...
like there's a very deliberate choice in doing that.
I feel like it's another strange instance where this podcast, where we kind of arbitrarily hit upon this opening 20 minutes, has coincided with the 20-minute mark always being on like a key moment of major movies.
It does seem
to be an ongoing pattern. I think we found that in Jurassic Park, wasn't it, like when they first see the dinosaurs or something like that? Like it's always some kind of bang on really important moment in the movie where they seems to always be the moment where we've kind of crossed the threshold and are now into the movie proper. And what we have in 2001, as you say, is it's 5 minutes of black and just music. Then it's about 15 minutes of monkeys discovering the monolith and then the first sort of murder between them, and then 20 minutes we're in space. And then with Barry Lyndon, we get something similar in a way. It's just around the 20-minute mark is when he's about to have the duel, which is kind of the inciting incident that propels the rest of the film. And then after the 20 minutes, it's probably about 25 minutes or something when he, or maybe just over when he's joined the army. And that's really the beginning of the movie where he's now traveling around Europe and being a scallywag in various ways and coming into power of having this kind of estate. And all of that kind of kicks off after this incident with the duel. And the first 20 minutes really just leads up to that duel.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of the 20-minute mark in this one doesn't feel it like the actual moment itself doesn't feel like it's sort of and not to give away where we'll go with this podcast, but it is the two guys walking in the field and then sort of discussing something that's going to happen later on. It doesn't feel particularly monumental in the way that the 2001 20-minute mark does. Mm. But obviously at this point, things are moving and it's sort of there, you know, pace has been gone. One question which I wanted to ask, because I think it's kind of important for our type of podcast, is can you remember the first time that you saw Barry Lyndon and your feelings towards it then? And has it grown since, or has it diminished, or that kind of relationship to it?
It's definitely grown, because I think the first time I saw it, I wasn't ready. I think like in my early teens, I saw 2001 and Barry Lyndon probably around the same time. Kind of, my mum was watching them on TV on like a Sunday afternoon or something.
Right.
And I thought both of them seemed like the most boring films ever, and because of that, and then like later on, I think when I first went to university, my first year at uni, a friend of mine put on Full Metal Jacket, and I already had this preconceived idea that Kubrick just made these very dispassionate, very boring, very sterile movies, and then he put on Full Metal Jacket, and I just completely applied that to Full Metal Jacket as well, and was just like, yeah, it's just a really cold kind of psychopathic filmmaking. And it wasn't until, actually, this is super superficial of me actually, but it wasn't until I saw like the box set reduced really short with all his films, because I was a sucker at the time for just completism with buying box sets and things on Blu-ray, or this was even DVD, and there was the Kubrick box set on DVD that I think, with the exception of his first three films, had like every single one of his movies in it, and seeing that set, and it was like, I don't know, a tenner on DVD, I was like, oh yeah, well I've got to own these Kubrick movies that I apparently don't like, and then ended up watching through them as an adult now, you know, as someone who'd like studied film for a bit and whose taste in movies had broadened. And I couldn't go back. I couldn't imagine why I didn't enjoy 2001 and Barry Lyndon. And ever since I saw Barry Lyndon, actually, I've just remembered this. Barry Lyndon was the last one in the whole box set I got round to watching. And it took me a while to get round to watching it, because I'd had this inflated idea in my head that it was this overly long, incredibly ponderous movie, and although now I liked 2001 and Full Metal Jacket and Clockwork Orange, I was never going to like the challenge film. It was always going to be this kind of really boring thing, and then when I eventually did sit down to watch it, I loved it, and I've subsequently seen it quite a lot of times. I was actually really surprised watching the first 20 minutes this morning, going on to watch sort of the first 50 minutes this morning. Even though I've seen the film quite a few times, I hadn't realised how much of the film takes place in Ireland. In my memory, the stuff in Ireland at the beginning is sort of a small prologue, and then the film is him running away from Ireland and going on all these kind of misadventures. How about you, anyway?
Well, it was, I think the first time I actually properly sat down and watched it is I was doing a thing a few years ago, which I really should keep doing, which was, there's a website which correlates all the kind of big film canons and the lists that kind of do 100 greatest films or whatever, and it compiled it into a list of 1,000 films.
Yeah.
And I was working my way through that. I think I got about 200 deep, and it's kind of just tapered off for one reason or another. But I remember that during the course of that, I got round to Barry Lyndon, and it was, you know, the sort of ritual of doing that list demanded that I sit with a very decent copy of the film and watch it back to front. And even if it was over the course of like a couple nights, which I think Barry Lyndon was, it was actually, no, Barry Lyndon, I literally couldn't sort of tear away from it. It was just one long 3-hour sitting, because like we've mentioned, it is incredibly absorbing. But I think the thing is that it's interesting what you were saying about rediscovering Kubrick and having this new relationship with him and still being averse to Barry Lyndon, because in hindsight, it is one of the only films of his kind of most celebrated period from sort of the 60s onwards that doesn't have any of that kind of salacious cult appeal. Like, obviously 2001 has kind of there's a lot of cultural references there, same with Clockwork Orange, and even like Eyes Wide Shut, the kind of the Venetian mask thing has become a bit of a, you know, like people relate that to that film. But Barry Lyndon doesn't have any of that. Like, it's kind of stripped of all that in a way.
I wonder if that's to do with it being a period movie to some extent. Like,
I guess
or
so.
at least a period movie that's not in a particularly, I don't know, exciting or generally romanticized part of history. Because you could imagine sort of more of a, like a World War II setting would still maybe have some of that carryover into pop culture. But
definitely,
Barry Lyndon is extremely slow. Like, it moves at kind of glacier pace, you know. And I think that's something that when I was a kid and I saw it was what put me off. But that when I was older really pulled me in. Because it really does just, it really takes its time. Everything in the film is very deliberately painterly, kind of based on Hogarth paintings and things like that. It's a cliche you can say generally with a lot of films. In fact, there's a very popular YouTube channel based on this idea of kind of every frame being a painting.
But I feel in Barry Lyndon it really literally is.
There's a few moments maybe of like Leonard Rosser pulling a strange face in close up where that wouldn't be a painting. But most of the film, certainly all of the more like wide shots and establishing shots and things, they're very painterly. And really beautiful to look at. The whole film is absolutely gorgeous. Again, another famous thing, and you'll know the technical kind of specifics much better than me, but the gist of it being that Kubrick had to use a NASA lens that was developed for taking photos like in low light in space in order to film the scenes with natural light, and in many cases it's most famous for the candlelight on a lot of the interiors.
Yeah,
which we don't get in this first 20 minutes. We obviously get that great natural light, but it's not till much later in the film we get those big kind of very lavish candlelit scenes.
Yeah. Very beautiful bit of, and kind of not really been, well, I suppose nowadays it'd be a lot easier to do that kind of thing with digital cameras, although it wouldn't look as kind of lush and sort of rich. And but anyway, that's kind of a bit of a digression.
It's something that really stood out to me on this watch, actually, thinking about how often with films from the 60s and 70s, not always, but quite often, you get a huge disparity between interiors and exteriors. You get this weird, like, studio, brightly lit thing on interiors. And it, not really in Kubrick movies, because obviously he was very fastidious in having things look a certain way. But often in films, you do get that real divide between exterior scenes that don't have the luxury of studio lighting and then interior scenes which are kind of overlit sets. And in this film, everything is natural light, and it's really incredible the way that the interiors and the exteriors still look exactly sort of the same quality, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I try not to get too technical about these things, because A, it's boring, and B, it's slightly irrelevant to what we're talking about. But in the case of this, I mean, the cinematography of this film is quite rightly accepted as some of the greatest in film history. But what really struck me watching in the 20 minutes is the interiors, and this is having a very basic knowledge, grasp of filmmaking, and having been on some sets as well, is that the lighting on the interiors is very, very obvious. Like, looking at the windows, it's very obvious to tell that it is not natural light. Like, through the, and obviously I've sort of watched like breakdowns of the cinematography and how they put lights outside and the technical difficulties of matching that with the natural light that was occurring in the scene anyway, is that they're just very, very bright lights outside, but they so perfectly create the effect that you would see, not necessarily in reality, but of those paintings, like those kind of 18th century artwork.
He had me fooled.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you don't sort of register that it looks weird for real life. You're like, this looks right for the scene, and I think it's a quote by him that's something along the lines of, I don't want to create a photograph of reality, I want to create a photograph of a photograph of reality, which is kind of a slightly abstract way of saying that it doesn't, you know, I don't want realism, I want the kind of
that certain distance,
a kind of analog of realism, a kind of representation of those, even in the smallest details. And in The Shining, I don't know if you've seen that documentary about Room 237 about The Shining, and how there's a lot of inconsistencies in the planning that someone like him would just never miss, but are clearly part of the design to disorientate you and make you feel like, and they're just so, like, they're low enough that you, like, it's stuff I didn't even notice on, like, the 10th watch, but you know someone like him would have thought about this on purpose to make things seem more uncomfortable in that sense. And I wonder how the same applies to this film.
It's interesting. So going through the film, the first 20 minutes in more linear fashion, you get the opening, and this is something that struck me as interesting. I can't remember any Kubrick film, certainly from his celebrated period where he's kind of making films in the UK and kind of had all that control, where you get the standard studio music and everything at the beginning. His music and his aesthetic always goes over from the word go, doesn't it? So you get the Warner Brothers or some kind of Warner logo comes up at the beginning. It's not the big Warner Brothers one, but it's like
the red one.
It's like a red one.
Tacky
70s black
one,
W,
yeah.
And the Sarabande, the handle tune that starts off in the background, comes in immediately behind that logo, you know. It's like, and I can imagine this is the case with him because of how precise he was with things. It's like he doesn't want his movie ruined by some burst of music or something at the beginning that's not selected by him or part of the whole experience. You know, as soon as you press play on it, even though it's the production company logos, you're already in the headspace of this music and this tone that he's setting. And then you get this music playing over these opening credits, and soon into that, this narration. The thing I always think about with this movie, even beyond the lighting and the candlelight and these amazing exterior shots, is Michael Horden's narration. I absolutely love it.
He's got such a great voice. voice.
Yeah, and that's the thing, the quality alongside the music that pulls me immediately into the film. Like this, the narration at the start where he's saying, you know, it was in the year of 17, da da da.
Yeah.
Redmond Barry or whatever. Like all of this kind of stuff is just super. Super immersive. And I think what's really cool about that narration, and I'm sure this comes from the William Makepeace Thackeray novel that it was the film was based on, I'm fairly sure a lot of that narration must come directly from the novel, and that narration is, it just has this real delicious sort of sly ironic quality to it, where the narrator is kind of speaking seemingly very
but it's
very
quite
respectably
wry
about things, but he's very wry about them, and he's actually sort of laughing at them, you know. And there's a lot in, like, at the very beginning, you see the shot from a distance of this jewel on this amazing kind of Irish landscape, and he's narrating how the main character, how his father died in a duel, and then makes a comment afterwards how bad it was all over the transaction of some horses, and the way he says it just. It implies that the whole business of all this formality, all this pomposity, all this dueling, all this ceremony, everything that looks so painterly and beautiful, is behind it is stupid. Like what these people are really doing is facile and idiotic in some way. That this pageantry, which the film on the surface at sometimes seems to celebrate because it's all very elegant and Kubrick shoots it so beautifully, but he's got that understanding in the background, I think, all the way through the film, characterized a lot of the time through the narration, that this is ultimately people acting strange as people do. A kind of almost Werner Herzogian sort of view of society.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like
the very
look at these strange people dueling over transactional this madness.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I'm trying, as I said to you before this pod, I'm trying to keep myself to 20 minutes, but I know, having like knowing the film, I know that exactly what you've said about sort of just the kind of, I don't want to say pointlessness, but the kind of just random futility of a lot of this, you know, the idea that the aristocracy, which is the kind of heart of this film, you know, they take themselves very seriously, and it's all about, they're the kind of masters of the universe, and they're, you know, they're kind of, and the kind of, there's the quote at the end, and this is a spoiler for anyone who doesn't want the ending spoiled, should probably, I don't know, maybe not listen to this pod. Watch the film first. But there is the quote at the end that's like, good or bad, poor or rich, they're all equal now, because they all become part of the pages of history. And there
they're
is
all
things.
Dead.
Yeah, yeah, there's moments later on in the film where he is walking into war. Like, there's the platoon or whatever he's in, the regiment, they're walking towards the enemy, just firing guns on them, and at any moment his life could be over and none of the rest of the film transpires. And that kind of sense of just, like, we're taking ourselves very seriously, and the business that we conduct is very important, and I demand satisfaction. You know, that idea of dueling and, like, wanting to be satisfied, and how essentially that can all be kind of, you know, pointless. We're all kind of just people. And anyway, I've skipped ahead, like,
it's interesting you say, because that idea of how history could have turned on the head of a dime and none of this stuff would have happened to him is explicitly said by the narration in the first 20 minutes. It's just after the first 20 minutes. It's after the duel, which I think is about 25 minutes in, and he's got to run away. And the narration says something about how if his cousin had never sort of, if he'd never fallen in love with his cousin, if he'd decided to just not throw the drink over the captain, this is all stuff we'll get to, none of this would ever have happened. But as it is, now he has to run away and leave his home, you know. So there is very much this thing of these small moments that have these ripples across history, but they're also are silly moments. I mean, they're stupid things. And I think Ryan O'Neill, who plays Redmond Barry Lyndon, I was reading, he was really criticized at the time as being kind of too wooden and not having the depth on screen to sort of portray this character over time. And I really disagree, because watching him, he seems so... He's clearly not the child that he's supposed to be at the beginning, because, yeah, you know, this is an old Hollywood movie where he's like a man in his 40s or whatever, being like a 15-year-old or whatever it is. But he definitely has this... I don't know how old he was at the time. He might be in his late 20s, his early 30s, yeah, but he's not how old he's supposed to be, right?
You know, he's
youthful
looking, you know.
But he makes himself seem very youthful, because he comes across in those opening scenes so naive, so sort of... fragile in the opening scenes, and he gives across as Barry Lyndon all the way through the film this kind of impulsiveness, this hot-headedness, this vanity, this selfishness. All of this comes out in his performance, and that's key to the character all the way through the film, you know. I think it's a really good performance, actually, from Ryan O'Neill.
I think Kubrick trusts that he's not going to do like Citizen Kane level makeup to show this aging. He's going to trust in the minutiae of his performance to carry that arc. One other thing that I wanted to mention, just something you were saying before, is I found out sort of researching this pod that actually the book that this is based on is all written in first person narration. So it's Barry Lyndon telling his own story, which was then I was trying to work out the link here, because obviously it was I think Kubrick opted out of that because he thought there would be a kind of unreliable narrator aspect, and that sort of the subjective tone would come off as kind of a bit too funny, and so he went for the kind of objective third person, just this disembodied voice telling a story. But clearly there is, I think, somewhere along the line of adapting the words of someone telling their own life into a kind of distant observer, you get that kind of wry, knowing sort of sense of humor creep in, you know, that's juxtaposed with a kind of objective storytelling kind of voice just going through the motions. It's a really clever kind of technique, actually, to weave those two together.
Yeah, I agree. You get at the beginning, you get this duel with his dad, you get this very sly narration about how it was all over these horses, and then you get introduced to Barry playing cards with his cousin, who it says is the kind of first love of his life, and you get this kind of very sickly, it does feel like a painting, because the light is sort of just luminescent, isn't it? Like, I know that's just a description of light, but you know what I mean?
Bouncing off glows, their skin, you know?
Isn't it? It kind of glows, They both kind of glow, and it's really interesting. One of the things I love about this film that is divisive, because I remember having arguments with people who were telling me how boring it was, and couldn't understand why I liked it for this, but it's how mundane a lot of the stuff is in it, like how just day-to-day drab a lot of what's going on in this movie is. And you've got, in that opening scene, you've got a very sort of 17th or 18th century, whichever it is, of idea of a rainy afternoon. You know, you've got these two people, it's raining outside, and they're playing this card game. And this love that's kind of his first love of his life, which, you know, in the first 20 minutes he'll abandon and piss off around the world anyway, is... You can kind of see how it's bored people with nothing to do, right? I mean, they're like, they live in this small part of, you know, rural Ireland. His cousin's playing cards with him on a dark, rainy day. And then she kind of plays with him a bit, really, doesn't she? This is the vibe I get from it. And I love that. I love when you see the kind of, the life in the army camp, and then, you know, having people taking the piss out of each other, leading to that boxing match, and all these little moments, these kind of slices of life of what's going on there that feel very or a really good one in the first 20 minutes, actually, is when you first see, and I think it's after this rainy day thing where the cousin makes him search for her ribbon inside her cleavage, and he does that. You get the scene of seeing the red coats of the English army parading around, and the narration talks about how there's rumours of a growing kind of war with France.
Yeah.
And all of the aristocrats are raising regiments to help towards the British army, and you get these guys in red coats walking around marching. And there's a lot in that. There's this sort of day-to-day boringness of there's nothing to do in this town, so of course everybody's turned up to watch some men in nice clothes walk yeah. around. Like, that's yeah. like the most fun thing to do today, is to go see the yeah. men walking up and down. And you hear how he's kind of thrilled by them and jealous of the way they're dressed and everything, which, again, like, it's all propaganda to get you to join the army, isn't it? You've got these people yeah. marching around in these uniforms, you're supposed to want to go and join them.
Yeah.
But also you get, just like in the narration and the sly kind of laugh that it seems to be having at these people, you get Leonard Rossiter, who's best known in the UK anyway for Rising Damp and yeah. The Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin.
He's so good in this film.
And he's like, so amazing. And, yeah. and he's brilliant. And he's this British officer in the regiment. And in that same way, as I say, with the narration that's sort of quite sly and I don't know, satirical is maybe too strong a word, but in that direction, you get him pulling these most ridiculous faces. Yeah. He looks so stupid walking around.
He's taking himself so serious yeah. to the point. It's like an uncanny valley yes. of seriousness.
Yeah, it
you
is.
Know, where he
it
just
is.
Becomes like so ridiculous.
And that's the thing with this movie in general, I think. It manages to have this wit to it, this comedy to it, without ever at any point seeming to not take itself 110% seriously. Everyone yeah. in the film is taking themselves very seriously. No one in the film is really joking or thinks they're silly, but Kubrick is clearly aware that lots of these people and the way they act and behave and the way that the world turns on these twits having these issues with each other or of being offended by this or that is silly.
And he, yeah, he and kind it of amounts clear that to nothing, silly. Really.
Yeah, 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 exactly. In that final line you mentioned about, you know, all are equal now, it kind yeah. of alludes to the fact that whatever pomposity, because you get the Leonard Rossiter character a couple of scenes on from this bit, saying about how I'm an English gentleman, I've got yeah. land, you know, I'm
yeah, I've got property,
know, I've got property, you know, yeah. and it's so silly. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And this whole thing of having property and aspiring to be landed gentry is kind of what the whole movie's about. I mean, that's the main motivation for a lot of what Barry Lyndon does in the course of the yeah. movie. And it's the main mover in terms of whether or not the cousin's going to go off and marry this officer, which leads to the duel. But this man, with everything they want, the money, the property, he's a snivelling kind of, I don't know if coward's the right word, but he's
just
certainly
like a shrew.
During the,
he's very
during,
shrewy.
He is, but during the duel as well, he is shown to be quite rightly
so
utterly terrified, despite yeah. this kind of outward presentation of being this kind of gallant man of war.
Yeah.
And he's so up himself about having property and so hoity that it's the very goal of everyone in this film is to become like this guy, who's clearly a nitwit.
Yeah, like he is the sort of ideation of all these bored people. And obviously in the story, his cousin as well, that Barry's cousin, she then obviously falls in love with him because he's like, well, I mean, there is the whole kind of financial reason that yeah. He's going to come in and sort their family's debts out. But also, I mean, he's clearly like not more attractive than Barry Lyndon.
Right,
it's just
yeah.
it's a matter of status. And I think it's that thing. It's kind of like the thing of, you know, the Social Network style narrative where it's like being sort of spurned by this girl leads you to desire this kind of status, which will solve all your problems in a very kind of slightly facile way. It's a similar thing in Barry Lyndon that I think that, and this isn't to do the film down at all, but the narrative is very episodic in that it takes you from one moment in his life to another, and you see the sort of, although there is a through line there, it's like the through line being, you know, like this desire for status and not necessarily for, because in the end it doesn't become about wealth or, in a sense, it's not really about power. It is just like being respected in a way and earning respect and losing respect and all these kind of things.
Yeah, it is.
And again, I have jumped way ahead into the film. I keep doing
but
this
yeah,
every time
no,
I do a part. I get
but
way
it is,
ahead
it is
of
that,
myself.
Isn't it? He's on a quest to sort of matter. He realises yeah. at the beginning of the film in a way that he doesn't matter, that he's not really respected.
Yeah.
And then he finds a way to amount to something in this very small, very silly way, which involves some duplicity on his part, and he becomes, or not even becomes, not a very nice person. I think we just see that he's not a very nice person.
Well, I think it's just that he is human is the thing. And
yes,
that, you know, the idea of status and kind of wealth and power or whatever was valued at the time, whatever he values to be, kind of betrays the humanity that he has to suffer in order to, you know, get this thing. Again, spoilers, because, you know, that's we're just there at this point, is that later on he loses like genuine loved ones. Like he gains things in his life that he loves and he loses those, and it's incredibly heartbreaking. I remember thinking, and I still think now, people make a big huff about how Kubrick films are cold and they're so ideas focused and they're unemotional, and this is my end of argument for that, is this film is like by and large the most emotional of any of his films. Like you feel kind of this, you know, at one point you find him, like you sympathize with him because he's a kid and you think, oh, young kids sort of run around. At one point you hate him because he does some horrible things and is really disrespectful. You feel that love that he has for Lady Lyndon later on. That scene where they kind of you know, kiss in the moonlight is unbelievably emotional. Like the passion in that shot. Yeah, and just complete silence. No dialogue. It's just he walks out and there's just the music gently playing over the top. And like then he just leans in to kiss her and it goes on forever, but you feel every kind of minute motion in there. And then later when he loses his son, which is what I was talking about before, that is just unbearably painful. And suddenly this guy who you hate for all his aristocratic kind of bollocks, you suddenly feel incredible, is just reduced. And then he has the duel with Lord Bullingdon at the end of the film, which is, for my money, one of the greatest scenes, not only in a Kubrick film, but I think just in film ever. The whole way that sequence plays out, and he decides that he's not going to duel, and he sort of, again, it's no dialogue, it's just these little actions. He points his gun to the ground and fires because he's going to allow himself to be shot. And the whole way that play, like it's so unbearably tense and like incredibly heart-rending at the same time. And so to say that he was completely unemotional throughout his career. Anyway, that's a little point of mine. I've always held that as a kind of intention with him.
I think this film's unemotional in the same way that people might find Brief Encounter unemotional. And it's because both films have that kind of repression of a lot of things people won't outwardly say and show, that's kind of bubbling under the surface, you know. I think it'd be easy to watch Brief Encounter and go, oh, what a bunch of 50 stiff upper lip people. They can't talk about their feelings, but them not talking about those feelings is the emotions of the film. You know, that's where all the feelings are, and where that's a, there's are, a lot of that in Barry Lyndon, I think. And I think it's, I do agree with you, I think it's definitely his most, I think it's his most earnest and emotional film. I think he didn't, I don't think he made another film with the same earnest kind of level of feeling for the characters. I think usually, and I don't say this as criticism because I love Stanley Kubrick movies, but I don't think any point we're supposed to care about Alex Delarge on a on an emotional level, or and there's not really any way to invest emotionally in anyone in 2001, you know. And and obviously everyone in Doctor Strangelove is a buffoon, you know. So I think this is his most sort of emotional film in that level. I guess Eyes Wide Shut maybe returns to some similar sort of territory.
If this story was set in the same time, but it was like just about poor people, like it was about the lowest rungs of society, I just think it wouldn't work at all. You know, it's like it relies on that sense of pomposity, that sense of self-importance and place in society for those emotions to ring like as loud as they do, because it's about how those things, you know, betray our humanity and what we go through. Anyway, I've gone way ahead. I've cut right into the film. I do this. You say, you come to me, Rob, and you say, take a slice, take a 20-minute slice, and I just bash my head into the cake like some mad feral animal.
You see the same stuff in Barry Lyndon in terms of the society that you get in, I mean, Dickens was writing about a later period, but you get this same sense as well of aristocracy in decline. You get this same sense throughout the film of, because his uncle's family that's got the debts and wants to marry the cousin off to the captain, they're not poor. They've got kind of a nice big house and they seem to be a fairly respectable landed sort of Irish family. But the thing is that like a lot of the characters and things like Nicholas Nickleby and all, loads of Dickens stories, there's that thing of the big, I think lots of Austin does this as well, where there's the big estate that no longer has the money it used to, and it's falling to pieces, and they're just having to sort of scrape by because they kind of rose and now don't have the prominence maybe they once did. I think you get a lot of that towards the end with Redmond Barry's kind of estate. You do get that feeling of it all kind of going tits up, you know.
they're not
able to sustain it anymore, which I think is great. I think it brings in a lot of stuff from the time period that's really entertaining. Also, how something I've always loved about the movie, and this again doesn't happen in the early first 20 minutes, but it's how international the film is. The fact that you get this Irish character who joins the English army, who goes off to continental Europe, who marches all around Europe fighting for different sides, which I love because it shows just how arbitrary kind of nationalism and things are in this kind of almost like pre-nationalist world, really. Nationalism hadn't really been born yet, or was only just in its infancy, and so obviously this Irish guy can fight for the English, then fight for the Germans against the English, you know, it doesn't matter, because he's just trying to get paid and get station and climb the ranks, and the idea of war, as it always historically was, as a means for poor people to advance socially, to achieve through fame and in glory in war, elevated social status, to eventually become aristocrats themselves, and you get all of that in there, which is just an interesting, it's interesting color to the period of time, and that's not necessarily something, you know, Kubrick obviously didn't invent any of that, but it's something that I think comes across really well in the film. I think as much as it's very stylized, you get a real flavor of the period of time, I think, and the way that Europe was during that period.
I feel like the thing they always say about period films is, or at least the kind of thing you see in screenwriting books and stuff, is you can't do a period film if it isn't in some way about modern times. There's just kind of... If it's literally a historical account down to... Then it's kind of pointless. And I think really here, obviously it's made in the 70s, but I still feel like there is kind of very universal things in there. Which is, like I said before, is that, you know, these ideas of status and power, they betray our kind of humanity. And I really think he understands that. And I guess it's... I couldn't speak for the book because I haven't read the book. And there, obviously, Kubrick has never been a 100%
faithful
adapter of books. But something that occurred to me just about going back to the first 20 minutes is how it is... it's really like richly, it's like it goes straight for like, it's about love, like the whole vibe of love, like that sort of musical cue, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's sort of like a, it's almost like an Irish folk traditional song. It's sort of played on like I can't remember, like sort of Irish flutes. And do you know the one I mean? It's sort of, it kind of runs the first 20 minutes. It's sort of very sprightly and wistful and kind of that longing romance. But I found it really interesting that he doesn't go for like, in the opening kind of section, he doesn't open on like, war and it's Britain versus France and the smackdown of this century. And who's, you know, it's not, and this is Barry, he's a young diehard. Who's gonna, you know, it's just like, it's a guy who's in love. And it's so, for 20 minutes of time, it's not even a scene. It's like that theme, that sort of love theme plays in different iterations throughout the first 20 minutes as he's struggling to hold on to the affections of his cousin who he's in love with against this guy who comes in. And you don't see any real display. I mean, there's the kind of, they turn up and they do the march and you realize contextually where you are in history and what's going on between these countries. But it is just about him and this girl that he likes, which obviously sets the stage for where he goes later in certain terms.
But I think that's what I like about the way it uses the historical period, because you get this immersion of it where, if you're living in a small village in Ireland at this time, the broader conflicts and what they're about kind of are irrelevant. But men turning up in nice uniforms and the idea of socially advancing through the army, that's interesting to somebody. But the people obviously themselves aren't talking about France or, you know, aren't bothered about any of that.
He doesn't open with like the sort of text you see in most like, pyramid the
Europe
being, like,
is at war.
It's the 18th century. It is a time of war. You know, he's just like, he gives context to the person. Like, it's like, here's Barry's dad and he got in a duel and he got shot. So his mother devoted herself to Barry, but immediately it's like he's in love with his cousin, and it kind of goes for what would traditionally be like late second act, early third act kind of love story, or like maybe sort of middle of the film falling in love kind of tones with that very romantic music and that the kind of very romantic things. He opens with that, and you know, any more conventionally structured film would move that, I think, later into the film where it wants to go deeper and sort of strike. Like, he has the confidence to open with that and know he's going to go like even deeper than that to places that you will still be interested in. And I think that sort of is a, you know, same with 2001. It's like, I'm going to open on silence. I'm going to open on pre like life on Earth, you know, and trusts that you'll go with that knowing you're going to go somewhere else. You know, you haven't reached the apex of interest, you know, even though these are the most interesting things. And I guess it's just because he spent so long putting these things together. He had so much to work with. He could kind of configure it however he wanted.
Mm. I think to finish the 20-minute description, which we just we've obviously wandered away
we
from.
We abandoned
as
it.
Always,
so
as always. So
yeah.
Basically, just to sum it up, the dad dies in a duel. His mother just dedicates her life to looking after him. It doesn't really pay her much respect, to be honest, going forward.
Yeah,
but whatever.
You don't really see her that much.
Yeah, well, that's the point. Yeah, after that point. And then he's playing cards in the room with his cousin. She gets him to find the ribbon in her cleavage. It's a very repressed sexually charged
thing,
scene,
yeah,
where oh, we shouldn't, and he's kind of just very slight, small touches of these big kind of erotic moments in this between these two very clothed individuals, you know. Mm. And then after that scene, the army come to town. You see the captain. They have a bit of a dance. She dances with the army captain. He goes up to her, and he's like, well, they have this walk, and it's one of those lovely shots you get them walking through the trees. Another one of those really great. Could be a painting sort of shots, and he's saying, oh, why do you dance with him? And she's going, well, come on, you're a boy and he's a captain, and if he wants to marry me or whatever, I can't say no, you know, he's got
and
money.
I love
and
that
everything.
Line in that walk where she goes, if you dance with your cousin, it looks like you've got no one else to dance with, even though they're engaged in this kind of, you know, tryst.
So then the kind of word gets to him that she is going to marry him because this guy can kind of settle debts. So he marches on over and causes a bit of a scene, and Leonard Rossiter sort of goes off going, well, in England,
I love that line as well, because her brothers, who I guess are also by extension his Baron's cousins, they're desperate to, like, you know, like they're sort of at captain's feet, and they say, we'll introduce you to Irish ways, or we'll adopt English ones, you know. And it's like that funny kind of sacrifice of principles, just trying to get what you want.
Yeah.
It's like, well, don't worry about our Irish ways. We'll adopt English ones. I think that's really funny.
Yeah, it is funny, but it also comes from a place of they're several thousand pounds in debt, and he's going to pay that off, and he's going to give this kind of family that's falling on hard times this monthly stipend of like over £1,000 or something. So there's a lot of money at stake for this family, which is another way in which Barry is a bit of a douchebag in this film, because he really doesn't. I think. I don't remember the name of the actor, the fellow who becomes his second, who he gets that friendship with. He kind of makes the point of saying, look, your uncle took you in and looked after your family when your dad died. Is this a way to repay him? And Barry just does not give a fuck. So Barry interrupts this thing, gets a bit awkward with the captain. Then they talk the captain round off camera. So Barry turns up to this dinner at his uncle's house. The captain's there. The uncle's giving a toast to their future together because they're going to be married. And Barry doesn't applaud the toast. Instead, he stands up and he throws his drink in the captain's face.
He throws the glass and cuts him on the face.
He does.
Yeah.
And then Leonard Rossiter does some brilliant face. He gives great face in that scene.
He does. It's like the quivery, I don't know. He's so tense in his face that his whole face is like shaking.
I can't watch Leonard Rossiter without thinking of the Peter Serafinowicz show where he does his impression of Ray Fiennes, but it's always just an impression of Leonard Rossiter in Rising Damp.
Yeah.
and that's what I see now when I see Leonard Rossiter. But anyway, so he gets cut on the face, the captain, and he's knocked, and he says, oh, I'm being insulted in your house and all that. And Barry Lyndon says, well, you can find me for satisfaction at, you know, call on this house. So they're gonna have a duel. The guy who becomes his second, the friendly army bloke, he walks Barry home and he tells him, listen, lad, like, you know, your uncle's a good bloke. Just, you know, you can understand they need the money. And then Barry's like, no, I'd follow this man, you know, to the church and kill him if I had to. You know, I'm not going to stand for this. So the guy, I love this bit where the big guy's like, give me a kiss, lad. Bring him in for a kiss. And then he says, you know, as long as I'm alive, you'll never want for a friend or a second. Then it cuts to the duel. And the 20 minutes is up at this point. The 20 minutes ends during that walk where he... Yeah. It's actually like when he says, give me a kiss, lad, and pulls him in. I think that's around about where the where the 20 minutes ends. But immediately following that, I think you do very much get to the end of Act 1, which is to say you get... the duel, and the duel is the instant where he does kill Leonard Rossiter, and then everyone's like, well, you better get out of Dodge then, Barry, you've got to leave town. And that's the inciting incident for him to go off in the world and join the army. So I think that 20 minutes is, you're right, 20 minutes isn't the end of like exactly the kind of the this part of the film, but I think sort of 30 minutes is. I think as well, given that this is a 3-hour film and most of the films we've talked about so far are more like 2 hours, I feel like 30 minutes in the context of Barry Lyndon is 20 minutes in the context of everything else, especially because how slowly the film moves. So I feel like
the point at that it would be if he'd have cut this into like a standard 2-hour movie, the 20-minute point would have been after the duel.
The 20 minutes would have been him joining the British Army, which happened right after. So that's basically what happens in that 20 minutes. You get, in terms of what the film establishes in that point, I think you get, as we've already talked about, you get a good sense of the period, not in terms of the big macro conflicts and what's going on. You don't learn about who the political power makers are or what the economy's doing or what the war's about, but you get the sense of what it is like to be living on the land in rural Ireland as part of this kind of maybe faded gentry sort of family, and in that sort of climate, and seeing how magnificent the redcoats coming into town is and how pompous the British officer is, and all of this. You get that from that perspective, I think, and you get that sense of their place in the world. It's almost like Lord of the Rings in a way, not to patronise kind of rural Irish folk from the 1700s, but you know the sense in Lord of the Rings that they start off in the Shire and then they kind of go off and explore the world. So you get him at the beginning in this very rural part of Ireland, and they talk about Dublin constantly as like somewhere to go that's kind of 5 days travel away or something, that like he could go and hide there, lay down low, no one will know you in Dublin, like you know, escape to Dublin. So he and I think you get that real sense of the world from that, the world being a bigger place than it is now, like harder to get everywhere, people travel less frequently, but also a shrinking place, because this guy does end up traveling all around Europe. You know, he has quite an international adventure in his way, but it's still a time in a place where someone in a rural community would be like, oh, up at that Dublin, eh, you know, really far away. You know, 5 days to Dublin. So I love all that, the way it establishes the history. As I say, I think Ryan O'Neill imbues the character this kind of boyish naivety that he never totally loses, this kind of impulsiveness, like I say, a kind of a vanity to him, a selfishness to him, and that passion that you mentioned, that he does kind of genuinely love this cousin and he'll later love again several other times. And I think that's established early on for the character. In terms of setting up other characters, most of the characters at the beginning of the film are not present after the duel, more or less.
Yeah.
So that's not really a thing. But it does, I think, set up a lot of the themes of the film, which I would consider are that sort of... I think one of the overriding ones, as I've said, being that it likes to build up the pomp and ceremony of these kind of aristocrats and then slightly poke at it, slightly burst the bubble and say, oh, they're a bit silly, really. But in a very sly way. Like, I think you could easily watch the film and not even detect that. But I definitely think through the narration and some of the presentation, it's there, you know. Like, even later in the film when he's playing the card game with his future Mrs. Lyndon, there's that very strange, very... made up man, isn't there? I don't know who the actor is, but it almost looks like Joel Grey from Cabaret. You know, it's that very rakish guy, and he's got like a huge wig and a really white face and a very deliberate, you know, beauty spot on. And you know, you get these kind of things where there's a very sly sort of almost you feel Kubrick saying that it's a bit silly, you know. And yeah, I think that's one of the things that you get set up right from the opening narration that, that kind of carries on through the movie.
Mm.
What would you say would you see sort of established in that first 20 minutes?
Well,
that...
I find this kind of, this subject generally really interesting, of just not necessarily Kubrick, but or even filmmakers, but how stories deepen, you know, how it is, and obviously this is a big sort of point of discussion on our podcast, is how a film can open really strong and lose its way. And I think what that comes down to is, it's, you know, if I was a screenwriting teacher, I'd talk about deepening conflict and sort of rising conflict and making things more difficult. But I can't, all that really happens in Barry Lyndon is, it's not that the, you know, once you have a gun pointed, someone pointing a gun at another person pointing the gun at them, you know, that's life or death immediately. So there's not a lot you can deepen from there. But what you do, and I suppose it's true, if, again, what you were talking about Dickens and also this era of time, is you don't deepen the conflicts, is you just broaden the world, I guess. Is It starts in, I suppose, he's not poor, he's not like a destitute family, but there is, it's like sort of the outskirts. It's not high society, as high as it can go. It's not lavish manners and things like that. It's kind of smaller places. And
yeah,
so
this isn't a guy rising from kind of Dickensian poverty, is it? It's a guy rising from middle brow Irish aristocracy to try and become a more rich aristocrat with his own land.
It's a bit of a weird comparison, but thinking about There Will Be Blood is a similar kind of thing to this. Is, it's not like, you know, you don't have a montage of
that
Daniel
Plainview. That is a brilliant comparison.
Yeah, you don't have a montage of Daniel Plainview, like, playing cards, and suddenly he struck oil, and I'm going to go out and spend it all. And now it's like, slowly it goes from just one guy in a hole who has to crawl across a desert to nothing in order to sell this. Like, he's completely 100% on his own. And then suddenly there are a few more guys helping him out build this derrick to strike oil. You realize he's, you know, he's gone from silver mining to oil. So then he's sort of a low-level prospector, but he has principles and he has ways of doing things that no other kind of, no one else can promise. And then he grows, like, throughout the story, it grows to such incredible wealth, but over the course of the way, he's lost anything that means anything to him. You know, his son is gone, and he's just, like, this mad alcoholic, insanely wealthy, who's just shooting things in his manner.
I think
Barry Lyndon is very similar kind of thing. It's, like, a guy who, of principle, but is at odds with the world, and is trying to make something of himself so he can just get away from it, or, like, you know, the kind of thing I was saying about status. And but then it grows very quickly beyond his grasp, and he's struggling to keep it all, you know, the world around him, this this kind of high society, massive world where wars are fought and decisions are made, and, you know, you're a person of influence and power, it just becomes more than he can handle, and he kind of loses all grasp of it. I do still think it's episodic, but the reason that episodic nature works is that the world around him kind of broadens. So you can start a film, like I was saying before, very much focused on the high concerns of a sort of lower level of living, the higher concern being, like, who do I love? And I'm bored on a Sunday because I'm not, you know, I don't live in this kind of, like, rich world where everything exciting happens all the time. So I'm going to fall in love with this woman. I'm going to fall so deeply in love with this woman that I'm going to put my life at stake to defend my right to be with her or whatever. And then later on, you realize that it's same shit, different day. You know, it's like, I live with all this money, but, you know, the woman I love still probably loves someone else, or at least hates me. And I'm still really bored, only I have loads of money and nothing to do with it. And I find it really fascinating that just films in general, like how you deepen a world and how that deepens conflict without just kind of, you know, like I always find it really cheap when, well, not necessarily cheap, but it's become very formulaic in a kind of screenwriting class sense to start with, like, well, you've got to heighten the conflict, so make it go from this to being ultimate threat. You know, death seems to be the ultimate, like, well, I need conflict that can't be resolved, and death is like the conflict that can't be resolved in any story. So I'm rambling now. I've kind of gone off point, but I had it for a while.
I think what you said about There Will Be Blood's brilliant, because I think I hadn't actually thought of that parallel before, and I do see a lot of the beats you said for There'll Be Blood, even down to, like, losing a son, really.
Yeah.
They're all very present here. And although you've talked earlier, and I do agree that there is a way to feel a lot of empathy for Barry, there is feeling behind a lot of what happens to him, losing his son, losing love, etc. He is ultimately a massive shit, like Daniel
Plainview.
He is
Plainview.
A twat, yeah. And so he...
In a very different way, yeah.
It's a very... it is one of those films, I suppose, like Taxi Driver, or like you know, to bring it up again, the upcoming Joker movie, where you're not necessarily supposed to like the protagonist, you know? That's, you know, that's always interesting, especially when handled with as much compassion as it is here. And I think it's a very relatable fall from grace, and he has very relatable failings as a person as well.
Yeah.
But he is kind of a shit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is an interesting question that I put to you, just because it's something I always have to, like, stop and think about just to wrap my head around it, is the idea in at least leading characters, the idea of sympathy versus empathy, where something like Taxi Driver, Joker, Wolf of Wall Street as well, that, like, not very likable protagonists who do kind of, you know, terrible things in a lot of way. Why is that engaging? Why is it not like, I'm trying to think of a film where you just absolutely hate the protagonist all the way through. Like, genuinely, it's not a good film because they failed to make the protagonist any kind of relatable entity. Like, I've had arguments with people, not arguments, but I always take, you know, sort of, I have issue with people being like, well, I didn't like the film because they weren't likable. You know, I was talking to someone about Phantom Thread, and, you know, it's like, well, he's not very likable, is he? But there is an empathetic link that is, under those circumstances, those people, there is a humanity I understand. And that's not to say that I agree with Daniel Plainview, like, wiping out all his competitors and beating Paul Dano to death with a... But there is, I don't know, there is in that film, at least, a sense of loneliness that you understand, and a kind of misanthropy that I would never take to the extremes that he does, but sometimes you just want to be away from people, but that breeds your loneliness and it becomes this kind of horrible cycle. It's different in Barry Lyndon, though. I don't know what it is in Barry Lyndon. It's I think, again, his status and trying to make a name for yourself, I guess. Trying to find a place in the world and the prices of that and all that kind of shit.
Yeah, I think that's...
I don't know how you feel about that. I mean, I know there are films that you take that I think are held in high regard that you don't particularly have any time for because they are populated by quite hateful people.
For me, and this is difficult because we can't really with any certainty a lot of the time say what the intention is, right? But I think for me the difference comes down to, am I supposed to think this arsehole's cool? You know, in Barry Lyndon, I am not supposed to think this arsehole's cool. In There'll Be Blood, I am not supposed to think this arsehole's cool. In Wolf of Wall Street, that's a difficult one. Like, I can see both sides of that argument. I think I'm not supposed to think this arsehole's cool. I think I'm seeing why this life's appealing to assholes, and ultimately you see him do things that are not cool at all, like lying on the floor fighting over ham because he's so fucked up, or crashing his big boat. Like, it depends. I know some people watch that and say it makes him seem too cool. I question that. I personally don't think it comes across as particularly
well. There
cool,
is in the space, if memory serves, with Wolf of Wall Street, there is 4 minutes in that film where he goes from beating up his wife, like, brutally, to then, like, knifing open a sofa because he's hidden cocaine so he can literally dive his face and do as much cocaine, to punching Margot Robbie in the stomach again, to kidnapping his daughter,
getting her in a car
and
crash,
then, like, driving a car into a wall with his daughter in it. And at that point, you're like, okay,
this guy's a complete fucking asshole. Exactly.
Like, he's just a fuck up.
So I think, exactly. So I can understand when people, because I've worked in offices since that came out where people unironically aspire to be like that guy Fourth Wall Street, because they're happy to just think about the bit where he's in an office throwing a party and going woo, you know, and they love that. But I think as a film, the reason I like Wolf of Wall Street and I don't mind that he's a shit is because I feel like Martin Scorsese also is aware that he's a shit, and part of the film is about that. And I think it's the same. A lot of people don't like Coen Brothers movies where the characters are, certainly in their early films, a lot of people are like, all the characters are shits. But also, I think the Coen Brothers were aware they were dealing with flawed human beings who, you know, like William H. Macy's character in Fargo, he's recognised to be human, he's frail, he makes mistakes, he's a bit cowardly, but he's very human. I don't think they hate their characters as a result, but they're not
Llewyn
heroes
Davis being
either.
Another one that people can't get on board with because he's a bit of a jerk, you know, and he's just like, but he is like a very desperate kind of jerk,
and,
you know.
Yeah, whereas my counterpoint to that is there are movies like, this is a shit film anyway, so it doesn't matter, but like Wanted. Have you ever seen that with Angelina Jolie and James McAvoy? That's an awful film. And one of the reasons it's awful is the characters are awful, but the film is almost acting like it's an incel film before incels were so named.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Like one of the things the film is doing is saying, this asshole, he's cool. And I feel like that's a lot of, maybe I'm unfair on this because I'm just not a big Tarantino guy. I feel like sometimes when Tarantino rubs me the wrong way, it's because his film's about an asshole with a bad attitude and I'm supposed to think they're cool. I think a lot of action movies are about assholes with bad attitudes and I'm supposed to think are cool. Like the first Expendables film is just full of hateful people that these days you describe as kind of toxic males, really, in the way they behave with each other.
Slightly right wing.
This kind of right wing mentality, but we're just supposed to think every time they, I don't know, kick some nerd in the balls, they're cool.
Yeah, or like, they're like legendary action stars.
Yeah, or like characters in a lot of Michael Bay movies have that. Where it's just like they'll just be like, fuck you, science nerd, and we're supposed to be like, like those are the ones I've, so that's my very long-winded, probably 10-minute long answer to your question. But
no, but it is such an important
for me.
Question,
that's
though,
the line for me.
I think, because you watch something like Drive, which has no essence of like implications on, like, it doesn't have, like, I never need a film to be wrapped up in like reality, but something like Drive, you realize there's no grasp on people, like, and relationships with people, and like it's just like iconography, which is the thing about that is it's very enticing. It's like, yeah, that world, it's like an 80s world, and it's neon lit, like it's very enticing, but there's nothing to those characters and you're supposed to think someone who is so completely detached is in some way relatable, that I find really just very uncomfortable.
Drive,
you know?
Drive is about 80% soundtrack, 20% cinematography, isn't it?
And I gotta say, and I know people really go to bat for this film, I have no idea why, but it's not even good cinematography. Soundtrack's all right, but like independent of the film.
But
anyway,
I mean, it's got that kind of 80s neon aesthetic that then became all the rage, didn't it, in a post-Drive universe.
Although, and I get it.
The
like,
film doesn't even
something
really have that. That's more the poster. I think it's 80% soundtrack, 20% poster font.
Yeah.
Or maybe 8% soundtrack, 15% poster font, 5% jacket.
Yeah. And I think there is something, I get it. Like, you know, you have opening titles in Drive and it's like, there's this really roaring song and these great like helicopter shots of LA, and there is a kind of dopamine rush at seeing that being put together. The fact that it leads to nothing is, I mean, kind of neither here nor there. It's like there is something exciting. It's just that it doesn't go anywhere. You know, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Or at least on the question of empathy, I think this is really important, because in the same sense that people get sucked into like the Wolf of Wall Street and think that's a good idea, and again at Clockwork Orange people got sucked into the idea of like droogs, and we're like, you know, we don't have any money and we don't have any stuff, but we're young and we're like, you know, crazy, and you know, we can sort of have, we can manifest control over our universes doing terrible things. I think it's a really important thing, and I think Clockwork Orange definitely explores that, but there is a sense of that in Barry Lyndon as well, is that, you know, why do we like these people, why do we watch these people, why do we care about them, why, you know, we don't sympathize with them, do we empathize with them, because there is humanity there.
Well,
even in
get that from the cousin talking about Lena Roster within the first 20 minutes, right, because she basically says he's not much to look at and he is is a bit of a sniveling twat, but he is a rich army man of high station, and I think what that teaches Barry right at the beginning of the film is it doesn't matter if you're a good man, a nice man. You know, it matters if you're a wealthy man, if you're a person with estates and power, which again, saying it now seems like it's a kind of proto incel film, you know. But
it's kind of the way that Barry seems to operate.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, kind of guys nowadays who say, well, I'm not much to look at. I'm not super smart. I don't have a lot of money. I'm not well educated. I'm not a person of means. But can I make an impact on people? Can I, how do I gain power? Oh, I know. I can load a gun up and run around a movie theater and shoot a load of people, or I can go to school. You know, it's like these kind of false senses of power, you know, and status, and how that becomes warped. Obviously, I think in Barry Lyndon, it was probably more acceptable to have jewels than it would be, for now. But it is a very, I think it is a very timely kind of parallel that, you know, is so kind of innately human that a film like this isn't going to become sort of irrelevant in the same way. I'm trying to think of a similar period film which really just doesn't kind of ring true. Downton Abbey comes to mind, but I haven't seen it, so I can't say.
I'm sure it's awful.
I'm sure it's terrible, but I can't say why, so I won't pick on it unnecessarily.
You already have.
Yeah. Shots fired.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think there's a discussion to be had really around, and this is not really something we can do in this podcast. I feel like this podcast ended 20 minutes ago. there's a discussion to be had about whether, about what constitutes one of these films with an unreliable kind of nasty protagonist what constitutes one of those being a good film and an effective film, and to what extent does the filmmaker have a responsibility socially and influencing kind of in patronizing terms kind of the wrong kind of people in the audience? Because for example, like Rick and Morty is a great example of this. Rick and Morty is something that when it started and nobody else was really watching it, lots of people of a very sort of who would consider themselves to be educated, intellectual people were like, this is a really smart cartoon. It's got this kind of nihilistic view on kind of physics and philosophy and the world and our place in it. And it's kind of cerebral and interesting and silly. And lots of people really liked it, myself included. I still do like it. But also it reached a kind of critical mass where now lots of people like it just on the strength of people being dicks to each other and catchphrases and things out of context and things that maybe an attitude that maybe is not in line with the people that originally liked it, what they originally thought it was. And I think you see that with a lot of things, and I think it comes on again to Joker, which is so appropriate. It keeps coming up. We're talking about it just before the podcast, because it seems to me the inevitable backlash with Joker is a result of it reaching probably a very wide audience and it getting a lot of publicity. Because I think if you can imagine a film like that, I've not seen Joker yet, obviously, neither of you, but I can imagine if it was a $5 million budget film that flew under the radar and was like number 7 in the UK box office and then disappeared after its opening weekend, it would be seen, but it was as polished and everything and as well acted with Joaquin Phoenix, everything as it's been reported to have been. I think people would have said this is a very handsomely made, very interesting psychological look at one of these kind of incel mentality people, and it's well worth checking out. It's very well done. Whereas the fear now among certain sections of the kind of the intelligentsia is that it's been released into the world without any responsibility. They were so keen to see whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should, and now they've pampered it, they're selling it, put it on a plastic lunchbox, you know, and it's kind of gotten out there. And I wonder, kind of, this is the question really, is what responsibility does Martin Scorsese have to if idiots misunderstand Wolf is Wall Street? Do we have to go back to a kind of Hays Code Hollywood and have a sign come up at the beginning of the film that tells the audience the people in this film are very naughty and nothing they do is good? Or you know, are we unable to trust some of the audience? If a bunch of the audience, if 30% of the audience of Wolf of Wall Street goes off and thinks it's great to be Jordan Belfort, is that Martin Scorsese's fault? Did he let those people down? Has he done a bad thing in society? You know, I'm inclined to say no, and that it isn't his responsibility if some people misunderstand his film. film. But I don't know. Is that too easy? Is there a social responsibility
here? I feel like in the case of Wolf of Wall Street, the answer is no. But for me, it's very borderline because you have to understand that people will... You know, it's. I remember a thing being said about The Simpsons in this regard that is like trying to entertain. And again, this is very patronizing, but there is a problem, and I'm probably putting it very indelicately, but there is a point to be made for like the least kind of sophisticated members of the audience and the most overly sophisticated members of the audience is that you trade on a certain kind of vocabulary in cinema that indicates certain ideas and condoning certain ideas. It's, you know, is if you show, if you made Wolf of Wall Street and you shot it all in like really desaturated colors and all the drug scenes were kind of Requiem for a Dream level, like bleak, you're telling, you know, people a certain thing and you're not, you're through kind of like the language of cinema, you are communicating like this is horrific and horrible, and I think the argument with Wolf of Wall Street is that ultimately
it's
the
too
characters
slick.
Well, yeah, but the character's arc, you know, it does tell the story and it tells you this is not, this is an idiot at best, this is an idiot and this is someone who does stupid drug-fueled things, but at worst is just like a criminal and a horrible, like hateful human being. And I think it is there, but like you say, very, it's presented very slickly because it's telling the story of this world of slick people. And it's like, it's showing, like you said before, the appeal of that world and how it becomes so kind of, but ultimately the, how that betrays, you know, that's all false and it's all a facade. I think it could do more to sort of like create that balance, but I personally don't see that. But again, it's who is the ultimate kind of tastemaker, who says what is and is not acceptable. You know, you and I see The Wolf of Wall Street as one film, some people see it as a complete other. Same with Joker, is there is going to be people going one way, which is, oh, this poor guy who was kind of like, his mental illness drove him crazy, and another set of people are going to see like this absolute loser who gained control over his situation by becoming, you know, like, that's, I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see when that film comes out, like, where, what happens, really, you know, what the response is. I don't think it's for anyone to say, you know, that it is irresponsible before the fact. Although I suppose some people have seen it already, haven't they? So,
yeah.
Who knows?
I can understand that viewpoint. I mean, I've got my friend Dennis, who I do my other podcast with, 40 Projector Podcast. We've had discussions on there multiple times about Wolf of Wall Street. He comes definitely from the view that it glamorizes these people, and I kind of feel the other way, but I can see the other view on it. I can see that you've got a very attractive leading man, a very charismatic leading man, and you're surrounding him with Margot Robbie and with mansions and yachts, and then it's easy for a lot of the audience to go, that looks good. But I think it ultimately, and again, massive snobbery here, I think that says more about the audience than it does about the film. I think if someone in the audience watches this guy punch his wife, do loads of drugs, crash his daughter into a wall, and they think his life looks good, that seems to suggest to me that they are so shallow that having the mansion and the suit makes up for all that stuff. That's a problem with them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, this isn't anything new. Like, the idea of the Hays Code was to an attempt, before anyone understood what film, the power of film and what it could do, or at least in the early stages of seeing what it could potentially inspire, they were trying to just like shut it down and make a safe space where everyone, you know, you could have easy stories and there was no confrontation of difficult things. But then we later realized we needed those difficult things to be addressed as a way to fully understand them and even subconsciously just grow beyond them. But that came at the cost of, you know, in the case of like A Clockwork Orange, kind of copycat ideas, you know, Taxi Driver and the whole John Hinckley thing is, you know, there is a cost. But like you say, it's not, you can't just say, well, Martin Scorsese should have never have made that. He should have known. I mean, he should have seen like what happened before and gone, I can't make this, people. You know, it's like the issue isn't the film. The issue is mental health and all the rest of it.
I was reading this morning a Guardian article about Joker, kind of a fairly critical take on it. in which they mentioned that Joaquin Phoenix had walked out of an interview with The Telegraph because the person at The Telegraph asked whether he was worried about people in real life doing heinous things inspired by the film, and Joaquin Phoenix apparently got up and walked off. And obviously, again, not seen the film, so I can't really comment. But there is, I think it is another very difficult question, and I don't know the answer to this. I've got feeling about it, but I don't know where I stand, which is if the Joker comes out, and out of all the millions of people who see it, there is a weirdo who uses it as their stated inspiration to go and shoot up a room of people.
Yeah.
Is that the Joker film's fault? You know what I mean? It comes down again to this critique that's always gone on about media, video nasties and Grand Theft Auto, you know. Is it the society around that person that's let them get around to that, or, you know, or should people be more, I don't know, quote unquote responsible in the art they make? Certainly mass entertainment art, I guess, but to me that feels very snobby. To me that says certain people can't be trusted with this art and these ideas, it's difficult, isn't it?
In my opinion, it's a cyclical thing where these things are happening nowadays. And, you know, again, haven't seen the film, so we can't really say, but given that it's won the Golden Lion at Venice, there is some credibility to it having something to say about that type of mentality and that, you know, the journey someone goes through to become that character. And I think in interviews, stuff I've read already is that it's quote-unquote a real film disguised as a comic book film, and it's actually about something and engages with these ideas. But those and that's a reaction to things that are happening nowadays already. There are already school shootings. There are already shootings all over America. There are already very deranged people, very unhealthy, mentally unhealthy people. And you know, and let's face it, who are kind of young men, mostly. I can't think of, you know, any of these kind of modern-day shootings that have occurred because of unstable women, although that's a different issue that I can't even cross at this point. But, you know, that and the Joker is using those kind of, you know, this kind of iconography to talk about that. But then that sort of, that then will become confused in the whole kind of conversation. You know, it's trying to elicit conversation as a way to understand what's going on. But in that process, someone is going to get kind of riled up by that. And so, I mean, who knows? Hopefully nothing, you know.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely, I hope that it is just taken at kind of face value, and it is not face value, the wrong
one. Yeah, the other way.
Yeah, it's taken as it's kind of intended and not meant as something else.
I think really the only fitting way to sum up this question of filmmakers, do they have this responsibility, what's right and wrong, is that it was in the reign of Queen Elizabeth II that the aforesaid personages lived and quarreled. Good or bad, handsome or ugly, rich or poor, they're all equal now.
One day that will be true.
Todd Haynes will one day just be dust. And what he made with Joker won't matter a thing.
Todd Phillips.
Is it Todd Phillips? Who's Todd? Todd Haynes is...
Todd Haynes is Carol.
Yes, Todd Haynes is Carol. Todd Phillips is the Hangover guy, isn't he?
He is.
Oh, it's the Hangover guy directed it. Shit.
This is a new wave of, like, really awful, sort of lowest common denominator comedy folk creating, like, high art. Like the guy Scary Movie 3, who then did the Chernobyl miniseries.
Yeah, we're gonna have to wait for the masterpiece that's going to come from the makers of Pixels in a couple of years. It's going to be like Daniel Day-Lewis is going to come out of retirement for their next thing.
The Pixels guys. I'd do anything.
Right, well, I think we've
covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground there. Some of it unnecessary, potentially. But we've got, I think you've got a good hour-long Barry Lyndon discussion there, followed by 20 minutes on other stuff. But that's a bonus. Consider that a bonus episode, dear listener, if you stuck with
you're
it.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Joker's out now, isn't it? In cinemas nationwide. In cinemas everywhere. So I'm wondering if maybe, based on the fact
that this Friday, I think
this Friday
it comes out.
Based on the fact that we've spent so long talking about it and haven't seen it,
it's probably come out already.
But maybe that should be our next episode, because I'm sure we'll both see it.
Well, maybe, do the Trent Joker.
Yeah, maybe, because be cool, we've never done one for a film we've just seen at the cinema, have we? There's always been older films. Why don't we do a 20 minutes in on the Joker? We'll go watch it. I live in Spain, if listeners don't know, so maybe it's not out here yet, but I'll check. I will research that after this podcast. And if it's something we can both go and see, perhaps we should do that one next.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And keep half an eye on when the 20-minute... I'll keep having to turn my phone light on to check where the 20 minutes is. Yeah. Although, maybe it's ironic. Can tell me, because you're going to be projecting it, presumably.
I will. I can find out
Tell me the 20-minute mark.
I will find out exactly.
So I don't have to look at my watch. Tell me exactly what happens on 20 minutes.
It's my job to stay on time. ironic that a podcast which focuses on such a minute moment in time sprawls over close to an hour and a half.
Exactly.
But that's why I love doing it. It's great.
Well, thank you, dear listener, for sticking with us, if indeed you did. We are going to be back next month, possibly with the Joker. Tom, you also have your Five Easy Pieces podcast, don't you? Although that's on a little bit of a hiatus, isn't it?
I think we're gearing up to start going again. We've got, and I don't know if we should think about this, but we've got end of year pod to do soon, and also end of decade, because the last year of the 2010s.
Yeah,
so sum up.
I'm doing an end of decade podcast tomorrow morning, actually, with Dennis for 40 Projector.
Oh, already? Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
So we're going to start looking at the end of the decade. I've not made my list yet, so I need to get a shift on with that today.
Sure.
Perhaps we can talk about doing a similar thing with the best and worst 20 minutes of the...
Nice. Nice.
But we'll see. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that off pod. But yeah, thank you for listening. Check out Five Easy Pieces and 40 Projector for our other podcasts if you're a fan of this one. Please share this around if you found it interesting to like-minded film folks.
We're on all sorts of platforms
as
well.
We've expanded.
We've expanded. We're on Spotify. If you're not listening on any of these, then this is where you can get something. It's Spotify. And we are on Acast still, and iTunes, obviously. And there are a bunch of other small Stitchers. Maybe not Stitcher. But, anything you use, you can get the pod.
Yeah,
so
for sure. We're on everything now. You have no excuse. But the thing is, we're talking to people that are listening. So it's difficult to chastise them for not checking us out, really, isn't it?
I don't know why I said that.
Well,
I just feel like it's important podcast information.
It is important podcast information. Anyway, I mean, it can mean that your friend...
If you want to recommend to a friend and they go, where can you listen to it?
You can say
what I just said.
And even in the kind of half-assed way we know, because we don't know exactly where it's up. But you can, if you've got a friend who really wanted to listen to it, but said, oh, but I only listen to things that are on Spotify, now you can tell them it's there.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, I don't have Android.
Yeah.
I don't have Apple. I don't have iTunes. It's like no excuse.
Yeah, no excuse. We'll find you wherever you live. Maybe we should put it on YouTube as well.
Why not?
Anyway,
throw it up.
Anyway, let's end this podcast just short of the hour and a half mark. Probably be the hour and a half mark when you have music, wouldn't it?
Yes. I'll speed it up. I'll make it short.
Well, as always, I've been Robert Beams.
I've been Tom Oliver.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.